All right, continuing now with hour number two of our big two-hour weekend get-together here on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison, and here again is Carol Marks, the host of the program, with the second part of an interview that she began in the last hour with Albert Dragon. He's the author of Avalanche and Gorilla Jim, Appalachian Trail Adventures and Other Tales, published by Morgan James Publishing, and they talk about his backpacking the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Vermont.
Now, Gorilla Jim had a lot of experience hiking that you didn't have, and when you first started off, you told him that you'd gone out in the woods in New Jersey to test your equipment, and he told you you had more guts and brains. What's true? And you were still friends. And what strange, terrifying noises did you hear when you were out there alone and kept you up all night? And then were you surprised to find out where those noises really came from?
Yes. As I said, I didn't know anybody who backpacked, and I had to really learn by myself. So I went into the Pine Lands in New Jersey. There's a 50-mile-long trail out there to test the equipment. And the first night I was out, it was, as you can imagine, it's the woods, it's dark. I had gone into my tent to go to sleep, and I did finally fall asleep, when this tremendous noise came from the forest, and it sounded like, who cooks for you? But it was loud, and it was impossible to understand what was causing it. In New Jersey, they think about the Jersey Devil being out there in the woods somewhere, and I thought, this thing had to be the Jersey Devil. It could curdle your blood. It was like something out of the worst horror movie you ever saw. And it just bellowed and bellowed, and it went on and on, and eventually it stopped, and I was in my tent with this, my sleeping bag up over my ears. And something worse happened. I started to hear in the distance a pack of vicious dogs. And it turns out I was at a ranger station a few days later, and I described this horrible sound. And the guy said to me, that's a barred owl. I said, an owl made that noise? I said, it's enough to scare the daylights out of you. He said, yeah, it's ghastly, isn't it? But he said, yeah. He says, it frightens a lot of people. They don't know what it is. But that is a huge bird. And he says, you know what it's doing? I said, what? He said, it's trying to attract a mate.
And that's so funny. You know what? It's a good thing that human beings don't make noises like that when when they want to attract a mate. So, see, we're better off.
Yeah, right.
You, after you did the first leg of the trip, you decided to take a break because you were having some trouble, you know, on the trail with your breathing, and you had tightness in your chest. You went and got it all checked out. Your doctors told you your lungs were in fine shape. So then you went on to do some research about the mountains that you were traveling over, and I can't believe what you found.
Yes. I was surprised that I was having those problems because I was in rather good shape before I left. I bicycled long distances, and I exercised every day, and I did all kinds of things to get into shape. But what I found out is that there's a lot of pollution in the air. It comes in from the industrial areas in the Midwest and the Northeast. And this pollution has a lot of things in it, all the things you hear about that composes pollution. But it seems to collect at higher levels. You would think it would be just the opposite.
Yes.
But ozone seems to collect up at the higher levels, particularly in the Great Smoky Mountains. So originally they're called the Smokies not because of pollution, but because there's a certain mist and dampness in the air. But these things collect there, and they do affect your breathing. Later on, I found another reason for it. I had a backpack which never seemed to fit right, and a lot of people tried to refit this backpack for me, and it never worked. So what I used to do, because the thing was sliding down, is I would tighten up the hip belt, and that would keep it from sliding down. But what I didn't realize, and what Gorilla Jim it was about a year later when I was hiking with him, did realize and tell me, is that when I tightened up the hip belt, I was cutting off my diaphragmatic breathing, and it was making it tougher to breathe. So I loosened up the belt, and things worked out a lot better. I also got a different backpack, which helped.
So there you go.
Yep.
Now, you had so many experiences due to the weather conditions that constantly changed when you're backpacking and hiking, and you went from dense fog to cold downpours, and then you had stifling humidity. But there was one weather event that you had that made the newspapers, and that was that sudden Tennessee mountains really snowstorm. So what was that all about? Why was that so dangerous?
The storm was something that we didn't anticipate. The weather the day before had been beautiful, been about 70 degrees, it was sunny. As we went up this mountain, the weather turned. It started to get cloudy, then it rained. And although people don't realize it, in many mountainous areas, you can have a tremendous change in the weather. As you go higher, the temperature drops. And in an hour, the temperature can drop about 20 degrees, not just because of going up, but because of climatic conditions changing. So that night when we pitched our tents, it was rainy, but it wasn't a disastrous condition. During the night, I heard something outside my tent, and after a while, I realized it was snowing. By the time I got up at about 5 o'clock in the morning, there was about 7 inches of snow. The problem that you run into in snow is that it covers over the trail. Sometimes the blazes, those are the paint stripes on trees and things that you look for to follow the trail, they get covered by snow. So it was a Sunday morning, and I couldn't get much on the radio other than in some of the nearby towns they were canceling Sunday morning services. So I thought this was not going to be a good situation, because if they were canceling them in town and we were higher up where the snow is going to be worse, we ought to know whether to get moving or stay where we are. I couldn't get anybody by telephone, but someone had told me that if you can't get anything on your cell phone, try 911, which, of course, you should save for emergencies. But we thought this was an emergent condition, and I did call them. And they patched me into Carter County Rescue Service, and they told us it was going to snow all day and it was going to go into night. And I said, well, should we pack up and get moving? And she said, stay where you are. We're coming to get you. Until she said those words, I was feeling pretty good. But when she said, we're coming to get you, I thought, well, this is an emergency worse than I was realizing. And it did. It took them, I spoke to them, had to be about 7 o'clock in the morning. It took them till after 1 o'clock to get to us. By then, there was at least 14 inches of snow, and drifts that we stepped in were hip deep. And those folks did lead us out, and they explained when we were at the emergency center there, the Carter County Rescue Center, that the problem that you run into in snow is it's easy to get off the trail. Then they have the difficulty of trying to find you, because if you're somewhere near the trail, at least they stand a chance of locating you. But once you get lost and disoriented off the trail, it is very difficult for them to find you.
And I thought that was so interesting, because the snow can be so disorienting, even if you're not in, you know, looking for a trail. And,
right.
You know, I really never realized that. So that's a really good message, that you should try to stay put rather than getting lost even more.
Sure.
In your book, you write that when you met people on the trail and they asked you, or in the towns that you went to, what you needed, you often said you wanted a 21-year-old's legs and lungs, because there you were in your 60s. But didn't you say that tongue-in-cheek, because you really do believe that there are so many baby boomers that are hurting their health because they sit at work and then they come home and they sit more, and we really need Americans to exercise more of all ages?
Yes, it is very important for people to do more activity. The problem we have in this country, and it's getting to be a plague, is obesity. And in the last 30 years, the obesity problem has really mushroomed. As you well know, problem with obesity is it's a health hazard. It leads to high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, some cancers. They're even talking about Alzheimer's disease being related to obesity. So it's important for boomers and older people to keep themselves active. I think a lot of us now know that one way to help ward off osteoporosis is to be physically active. It seems like there's some relationship between maintaining calcium in your bones and the amount of your physical activity. So, people today are much less active, primarily because of changes in transportation. Years ago, people walked to places. Today, we hop in the car. Kids today, and adults as well, are prone to watching TV, playing with electronic gadgets, talking on the cell phone, instead of doing the physical activity, which they should do.
I know, Al, that you have said that, you know, hiking and being active is great for your health, but you went on to say that there are other benefits besides health benefits. So what have you found those to be?
There's a certain feeling of well-being that you get when you are hiking. It's sometimes difficult to translate this and get people to feel it, but when you're out in the woods, you're in a place that's almost a place of perfect peace. When you are walking all day long and you finally, and you see, of course, great vistas, beautiful scenes, you meet great people, but there's something about that wonderful tired feeling at the end of the day that most of us don't feel anymore. I think years ago we felt this more because there's a lot more physical work that we did. And that feeling of well-being, that the relief of stress, that feeling of getting away from your worldly problems, is something that you can't find except out there in the backwoods.
That's Albert Dragon in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is Avalanche and Gorilla Jim, Appalachian Trail Adventures and Other Tales, published by Morgan James Publishing. You can go to albertdragon.com for more information. You're plugged into A Touch of Gray.
A Driving Today Minute.
With gas prices bouncing up and down, and despite the current state of the economy, folks are still driving a lot. AAA anticipates coming to the rescue of over 7 million stranded motorists. They expect a nearly 1.5% jump in roadside assistance over the coming 12 months.
What's more, consumers are holding onto their vehicles longer, and some are cutting regular maintenance from their budgets, and this will cause the need for help to increase.
What can you do to decrease the likelihood of your vehicle leaving you stranded? Well, have it serviced frequently based on the recommended maintenance schedule. Then remember to regularly check and adjust tire pressures to the right settings. Inspect the tire sidewalls for cuts and check the tread for excessive wear.
And keep in mind that heavy use contributes to battery failure, so be certain the battery cables are securely attached and the terminals are corrosion free.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Here's the host, Carol Marks, in conversation with Michael Duffy. He's a Time executive editor, and he directs the coverage of presidents, politics, and national affairs for the magazine. He's got a new book called The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, published by Simon & Schuster.
Now let's talk about the President's Club and how it got started. It was at the inauguration of President Eisenhower in 1953, and President Hoover brought the topic up to President Truman, and that was such an unlikely partnership. So how did it come about? And what had they previously worked on, and did a friendship come out of this?
It's quite remarkable that two men like Hoover and Truman could be friends, much less partners, but they were. Starting during Truman's presidency, he turned to Hoover to work on a number of things that Truman knew nothing about and didn't understand, and Hoover, who'd been kept out of the White House all through Roosevelt's tenure, was thrilled to be back in the action. So that by the time Ike is inaugurated, Hoover says, "Let's start a club," and Truman says, "Great idea. You be the president, and I'll be the treasurer." And in a way, that started what has been a 60-year unofficial set of relationships between the men who sat in a chair. You know how difficult the job is.
And they're the only ones that can know how difficult the job is.
They really can't, not their kids, not their spouses. And so they share this thing, even though this kind of burden, this experience, even though they, most of them have nothing in common, and all of them have disagreements that are deep, some of them personal. And yet they all find a way to find ways to work together, even overcoming their sometimes vast differences.
And, you know, what was so wonderful and amazing about your book, you know, I learned so much. I mean, I would have never realized that, you know, President Eisenhower was so effective with President Kennedy when it came to that fiasco with Cuba and then that Cuban Missile Crisis. Here you have the youngest president, and then you have one of the oldest, you know, working together. And I didn't hear much about it at the time or anything.
I think Kennedy probably wasn't keen to, for everyone to know that he was leaning on Eisenhower, but he really did after that fiasco, and Eisenhower and Kennedy went to Camp David, and which was the first time Kennedy had even been there, and really read him the Riot Act, said you got to reorganize the way you're making these decisions, and you know, I warned you not to do it the way you wanted to do it, but I know of what I speak, and Kennedy listened the second time. So as a consequence, the Cuban Missile Crisis turned out a little differently than the Bay of Pigs, much better for the U.S. And so there is a kind of, you know, silent set of handshakes that take place between old presidents and new ones, tips on how to do the job, things to do and not to do. And the book really talks, really dives deep into these stories to find out what it is they pass to each other.
And Eisenhower, again, was terribly helpful to President Johnson after President Kennedy had been assassinated. I never realized how much advice he gave him, which he followed, and he even wrote out his speech to give to Congress. Amazing.
He came down the night that Kennedy was killed, met Johnson at the White House, got out a piece of yellow fooled cap tablet, and started saying, here's what you have to do tomorrow. And what was really amazing about Eisenhower's advice to LBJ was that he said, you got to continue Kennedy's legislative program. So here's a Republican telling a moderate Democrat that he has to carry out a liberal Democrat's program in order to bind the country together and seize the opportunity and carry forth the mission. It was against their interest to do so, but perhaps in the interest of the country. Really a remarkable handoff there at a moment of grave crisis.
And there was another time that Eisenhower gave, I think it was great advice to President Johnson about the war that was going on in Vietnam, whether we should actually, because we were just giving assistance, whether we should actually put boots on the ground and send men over there. His advice is something that we didn't follow up, and we haven't followed it up really in our most recent wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. But his advice was, you know, if you're going to do something and go in there and have a war, you've got to win, and you can't have just halfway measures.
Well, Eisenhower was much more of a hawk after he was in the Oval Office than when he was in the Oval Office, which is also very typical of the President's Club. They tend to be much more aggressive and much more, I would say, invasive. But that's also because their political legacy is no longer on the line. So the current presidents have to weigh that advice against their own judgment. And Johnson did in the end. So, again, we see over and over in history how many times these presidents offer advice that is good and not good.
Now, how in the world were you able to do all the research for the book and find out all these things that most of us didn't know went on? They are fascinating.
We read a lot.
I bet.
We talked to a lot of people. We interviewed three or four of the presidents themselves who were still alive. And we had some advantages as Time magazine correspondents that other people don't have in getting to those folks and in going into Time Zone archives, which are extensive.
And if you had to categorize the 41st President, George H.W. Bush, what would you say is his best personal characteristic? And isn't it nice that there is right now a unique and close relationship between President George H.W. Bush, his son, and President Clinton?
Yeah, all three, and even President Obama. There's kind of it's Herbert Walker Bush and his three sons, one real, one surrogate, and in some ways, Clinton is almost practically a member of the family now. He vacations with them. He took Barbara Bush to Betty Ford's funeral. And I think even the Bush brothers call Clinton brother of another mother, which is just hysterical. That has become a genuine friendship between Presidents 41 and 42. Clinton and Bush, too, actually have a little business going together. They hit the road from time to time and give speeches together for very large paychecks. That's the first business relationship inside the President's Club that I know about. So the whole thing is pretty kind of a hairball. That's quite an interesting group. And it's the current club is more interesting in this respect. Bush 1 and Carter were both born in 1924, and will turn 88 this year. Clinton and Bush 2 were both born in 46, only 6 weeks apart, the closest two presidents in birth age in American history. Just 6 weeks apart in 1946. And even they have developed a friendship. It's not as close as Clinton's with Bush's father, but it is a relationship that is real. So we have a very interesting group of four men in the club, plus President Obama.
And one thing I, was just, really intrigued to learn about President Clinton, and that was the fact that he really valued President Nixon's opinion, and he wrote him this memo about, how to handle Russia back then and in the future. And I guess it was such a great letter that he still reads it every year. Who would have thought about that?
Yeah, the Nixon-Clinton one is not a relationship we expected to discover, but it is there. It was real. It lasted for a couple of years before Nixon died in 1994. Nixon was keen to get to know Clinton. He'd, of course, known all the Republicans, Reagan, Bush. He liked Clinton from watching him, but he'd never met him. They did begin to have a sort of late-night phone relationship, which is just amazing when you think about it. Both men either were or were threatened with impeachment. They had some things in common, though. In Clinton's case, that was after Nixon died. And Clinton told us when we interviewed him that these last letters that Nixon wrote him were some of his most... He rereads them every year. So they, again, something about having done the job across generations, across party, really does bind these guys together in ways that we did not understand, et cetera. So that was, to us, what was so intriguing about this relationship. And one more thing, and that is that we all like to read about presidents, but we never get to read about them in pairs. And when you hold them up against each other and find out what they stood for and what they meant to each other and how they sometimes had deep and bitter rivalries, we have a different kind of understanding of the presidency than we had before, and that's neat.
Michael Duffy, in conversation with Carol Marx. He wrote The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, published by Simon & Schuster. You're plugged into A Touch of Gray.
Welcome to A Real Family's RealFun.com Minute. Despite what you might think, creating a memorable birthday party for your child can be a piece of cake. Check out these party planning pointers, brought to you by DuPont Teflon. 1. Set a timeline. Set a start and end time for the party. Schedule no more than 20 minutes for each activity, such as snacks, games, gift opening, and cake, and end the party before kids begin to melt down. 2. Plan group fun. Plan activities that involve all children, such as a treasure hunt or cupcake decorating. Avoid games like musical chairs, because they put some kids on the sidelines and create chaos. 3. Arrange for help. Hire a babysitter to help manage party activities, or, for a cheaper alternative, ask several parents to stay at the party and help out. This Real Families RealFun.com Minute is made possible by DuPont Teflon.
Is rust making your classic car less than classic? Your commercial fleet looking antique? Then use Chassis Saver Rust Preventative Truck and Auto Underbody Coating from Magnet Paints. It's your permanent solution to damaging rust and corrosion. Chassis Saver is the only defense you'll ever need to stop rust permanently. It's approved by the U.S. military and over 500 municipalities, public works facilities, townships, and DOT fleet maintenance shops. And it's number one at stopping rust and corrosion on snow and ice removal equipment, highway, construction, and general use vehicles. Just knock off loose scale and brush or spray Chassis Saver directly over rust. No primer or top coat is needed. Chassis Saver is the one-step paint over rust finish that locks out moisture and oxygen to stop and permanently prevent rust. Call Magnet Paints at 1-800-922-9981. 1-800-922-9981. On the web at magnetpaints.com.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. visit our website at www.atouchofgray.com. Gray is spelled with an E. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
In today's information economy, the success of a business is measured in more than profits and margins. The new and highly valued asset of modern companies is information, and the task of protecting this asset against virus attacks and network intrusions has become a complex endeavor. IT departments must be able to remove vulnerabilities by instantly deploying vital security patches and configuration updates company-wide. They must minimize the risk of downtime by automatically adjusting backup policies for mission-critical servers and workstations. And they must rapidly recover critical systems and data after an attack. Today's successful business keeps its information secure and available to the people who need it. For more information about managing and securing an IT infrastructure for today's enterprises, visit itstrategycenter.com. IT Strategy Center is brought to you by Symantec.
There's nothing more important to parents than the safety of their children. Nothing. Especially when traveling in the car with mom and dad up front, the kids in safety seats in the back. But you can't get on the road today without seeing at least one dangerous situation. Folks distracted on cell phones or eating or just not paying attention, putting you and the entire family in jeopardy. That's why you need a We See You mirror. It's a unique automotive safety mirror that allows both the driver and the front seat passenger to simultaneously see the children in the back. The We See You mirror can save a life. Simply installed, it's independently adjustable from both front seats and doesn't obstruct the driver's view nor block use of the factory mirrors. It's made in the USA of top quality materials and costs only $19.95 with free shipping. To order, go online to www.wecumirror.com. Isn't it worth $19.95 for this valuable measure of safety for your family? That's wecumirror.com, spelled out with no spaces.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined at this point in our program for the rest of the way as we enter the final half hour of our big two-hour get-together. We're joined by our senior correspondent, the one and only Richard Neer. And coming up in just a moment, Richard's going to be speaking with Terry Dunn Chase. Terry Dunn Chase is a writer and an editor. She has more than 30 titles in publication, and she's going to talk about a new book that she's written, and it's titled The Anxious Gardener's Book of Answers, published by Timber Press. The idea, Richard, of a gardener being anxious is kind of an oxymoron. Aren't gardeners relaxed and at peace with the world, or is gardening a stressful experience for some?
You know, it's like raising children. Oh. You know, you plant your tomatoes in the spring, and my wife has made a vegetable garden with tomatoes and squash, and I have planted pumpkins. Mm-hmm. She goes out there every day and waters them, and if one of the tomatoes mm-hmm. looks like somebody's eaten it, oh, no, it's really... Very stressful.
Who eats your tomatoes? Somebody?
Nobody has eaten our
Do your neighbors come over and take a bite of your tomatoes?
No, but we have rabbits who are neighbors.
Oh, okay.
And the rabbits may eat them, or the deer may come and eat them, or the little field mice may come and have supper at our tomatoes. So we've constructed this big fence. This is why these tomatoes are costing us $100 each. Because you can't just put tomatoes in the ground and let them grow. You have to put special dirt in so that they thrive. You have to raise the garden bed.
We do not
you
call
have
it
to
dirt.
Put a fence around it so the varmints don't get it.
We do not call it dirt. We call it soil.
Soil, yes. Right. Composted soil.
So,
amended soil.
So yeah, but you put a little chicken wire around it. Keep the critters out, you know.
Well, but chicken wire is kind of unsightly.
Oh,
you know,
right.
If you live in the suburbs and you have a garden, it has to look good.
Well, you know, I live in New England, and New Englanders love their gardens. I mean, they probably more than any other part of the country, New Englanders are whacked out about their not only their gardening, but their shrubbery and their trees and their plants and their. And if you live in a halfway decent neighborhood, I mean any neighborhood that people, you know, don't just pile their garbage in the streets, and you just leave your leaves on the ground, or you leave perhaps twigs hanging from a storm or something, your neighbors start to give you dirty looks. It's extremely keeping up with the neighbors in terms of shrubbery and gardens in New England.
Well, I think it's that way everywhere.
Yeah?
I think it's that way
really?
Everywhere. And the thing is that I just heard a report where the tomatoes, which are sold in the supermarket, are basically sold to produce as many as they can, as cheaply as they can, and they don't taste good anymore. And only homegrown organic tomatoes are the real thing.
Well, this goes back to the question that I spent much of my life having conversations with people about, and that is, did fruits and vegetables taste better when we were kids, or are we just so used to them that we don't find them interesting anymore? Especially juicy fruits like plums, peaches, apples, you know, fruits that, you know, oranges that you would squeeze or that.
Did you know that the average apple that you buy in the supermarket was picked 14 months ago?
Oh, my gosh. Are you serious?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't even know what to say.
So, in answer to your question, it doesn't taste as good as it did when we were kids.
How do they keep it from rotting?
Well, apples stay good for a long time. They keep them in refrigerated, huge places with refrigerated.
That is true. Mm-hmm. I kept a pumpkin going this year from Halloween all the way into the new year. It was, I think, all the way to February. Then it went... We've got to take a quick break. Good luck with the gardener, and then we'll be back and reflect upon this crazy thing called life. Richard Neer, our senior correspondent, will be talking with Terry Dunn Chase about Anxious Gardener's Book of Answers and more when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
This Your Family Today tip is brought to you by Nestle Pure Life Water, helping you drink better and live better by providing a zero-calorie alternative to sugary drinks. Visit us at nestle-purelife.us. When kids are playing, they often don't want to stop to keep hydrated, so send them out with a bottle of water and encourage them to take frequent drink breaks or call them inside for a quick sip. For more tips like these, visit us at parenthood.com/yourfamilytoday.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
This Your Family Today tip is brought to you by Stouffer's, helping bring your family together with wholesome dinner options, even on the busiest of nights. Find dinner table ideas to bring your family together at letsfixdinner.com. To get kids involved in dinner time conversation, ask specific questions, not broad ones. Instead of what happened today at school, try what was the best thing that happened today. The more specific you are, the more they'll have to say. For more tips like these, visit us at parenthood.com/yourfamilytoday.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and as promised, our senior correspondent Richard Neer will now speak with Terry Dunn Chase. She's a writer and editor with more than 30 titles in publication, and she and Richard are going to discuss her new book, The Anxious Gardener's Book of Answers, published by Timber Press.
It's a perfect time of year for that because this is when people plant their gardens.
Thanks for having me, Richard. It is. It's a great time of year to get going, but sometimes people are novices or they've had a lot of disappointment, and I wrote this book for those people because it's hard to find good gardening advice, you know. We live in a busy world where you can't really get gardening advice over the back fence too easily anymore, and I think sometimes a lot of people will just go Google their gardening question. And of course, that's a little dangerous because you get way too much information. It's like drinking water through a fire hose. And sometimes you get conflicting information on the internet. So this is a small, little, unintimidating book full of basic information.
Now, what would you say is the number one mistake that people make when planting a garden?
Bad dirt, Richard.
Bad dirt.
Bad
okay, well,
dirt.
Define bad dirt because we're in the Carolinas and we have this red clay, and that's probably the very definition of bad dirt.
No, unless it's a native plant, it's not going to like that.
So, but you also say in parts of the book that very often people make the mistake of putting a lot of soil amendments in, and the plant actually needs to adapt to the native soil to survive long term, right?
That's the advice I gave for planting a tree. It used to be the common advice is to assume that you always have bad dirt, whether it's red clay or something else, and to improve it with, you know, stirring in some organic matter. We can talk about organic matter if you want. But basically, trees, when they're put in an improved hole of soil, will never leave. They will just wind their roots around and within that hole and never venture out. And, of course, that stunts their growth. And you need to give trees, in particular, tough love and put them right in the native soil.
If you're planting a vegetable garden, you want to bring in soil. And what kind of soil would you be looking for, let's say, if you're planting tomatoes?
Good, rich, organic loam. Now, you can dig organic matter into your red clay and mix it up like cake batter. Or you might just decide to put in raised beds and just fill the raised bed, which is a sort of a bottomless wooden box on your yard soil. And, you know, fill that with good stuff. One point I make in the book again and again is that there's no one way to fix things. There's no one right answer sometimes.
One of the other problems you point out in the book is planting things in the wrong zone. Looking at a plant in a magazine and you say, boy, that's beautiful, I want that. And it's not really suited for where you live, right?
Right. For example, here in upstate New York where I live, and planting an avocado is a dream of mine, but it isn't going to work. Because that's a plant that needs a warmer climate. I would say when you're shopping for plants for your garden, if you buy them locally, you should be fine because, you know, no local garden center is going to sell you something that's going to fail. But when you shop for your garden by mail, be a little bit more cautious when you're looking for that dream plant and see if it's suitable for your area. All you have to do is ask. Those people also want satisfied customers. Can it grow in my zone? The zones are just climate zones throughout the United States. It's a map that you sometimes see inside the cover of gardening books, or, you know, you can find the USDA zone map online. But basically, it's just, you know, zone 10 is deepest Florida and zone 1 is way up on the Canadian border. Probably where you are is zone 6 or 7, I suppose, but you don't have to get all worried about that. Don't get anxious about your zone. Just shop locally and you'll be all right.
Are you a big fan of composting?
I love composting. It reduces my household garbage by half, and I get free compost for my garden.
Now, what are things you don't want to put in your compost?
Meat, bones left over from the barbecue, you know, the chicken carcass, things like that. Only put vegetable stuff. And don't empty the bird cage or the guinea pig cage into there either, even though you think that that's organic, because, you know, some of your household pets will have diseases or, you know, parasites or what have you. Just put kitchen scraps in, including coffee grounds. I've noticed a lot of coffee shops will give you free coffee grounds for your compost, by the way.
Terry, lawns seem to be particularly a problem because to keep them weed-free, you use a lot of water, a lot of fertilizer, which, of course, there's runoff, and that can ruin our water sources. What are some of the alternatives and some of the guidelines you'd give about lawns?
Well, you know, the mark of a real gardener, or someone who's gone over to the other side, gone over into gardening permanently, is someone whose lawn gets smaller and smaller over time. Because the truth is, you know, the unfortunate real truth is that lawns are a lot of work. They're a time suck, and they are a resource grubber, and, you know, there are a lot of things that are a lot easier, including, say, ground covers. You know, there's a lot of good ground covers that once you get them planted, you know, plant them in a checkerboard pattern and lay down some mulch to keep the weeds down while they grow, and then they'll fill in, and then, you know, you never have to mow it. So I would rather
recommend
a ground cover instead of a lawn in some cases. And alternatively, you know, do your research on the grass that you're growing. You know, if you're filling in a new area with grass, go down to the garden center and get somebody who knows what the heck they're doing and have a conversation with them about your options. You know, maybe you can grow a blend of grasses and, you know, get a nice look and get things that grow well for you, or something that's appropriate for your soil and whether you have sun or shade.
Now, you mentioned mulch before, and moving to the South a few years ago, they use pine needles constantly as mulch, whereas up north we use cedar and pine bark nuggets and things like that. Why is that? Is just the availability, and which actually is better?
I think that any mulch is a good thing. But going with what you've got is obviously good. I mean, I think it's a real shame when people, you know, rake out all the stuff underneath their trees and just bag it up and put it at the curb. That's such a waste, you know. If you have things that can be in your yard that can be used for mulch, use it.
Terry, the plant that, let's start simple now, the plant that is the easiest to grow, cultivate, eat, enjoy, if you're starting a garden, what would you recommend the novice begin with?
I would recommend tomatoes because, you know, there's two things in the world money can't buy, true love and homegrown tomatoes, as the song goes. Once you grow a homegrown tomato, you're hooked on gardening because they're so delicious compared to those awful things you get in the grocery store. And tomatoes need very basic things, decent soil and sunshine and regular water. And, you know, if you meet their basic needs either in a pot on your patio or deck or out in the yard, if you meet those basic needs, sunshine, water, and good dirt, you will have a wonderful harvest and you'll be thrilled.
I can tell you, though, that it's not economically great the first year or so because of the expense of getting the raised bed, you know, the cedar and bringing the dirt in and the, you know, the tomato cages and then the plants. So at first, it is very expensive.
You know, going forward, and also we were just discussing composting. If you, you know, get a composter and make your own compost, then you that's great stuff to have, and it's free, obviously.
And it's a long-term thing. I mean, I think we're spending probably $50 each tomato the first year, but after that, it becomes a lot better.
Yeah,
Terry, thank you so much for
confidence and get some experience. You know, you will find lots of ways to economize and maximize. One message that I really hope people get from my book is that you can do it.
Terry Dunn Chase, in conversation with Richard Neer. She's the writer and editor of more than 30 titles and publication, and her new book that they discussed is called The Anxious Gardener's Book of Answers, published by Timber Press. Richard returns for a few more words as we wrap up hour number two of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.
This Your Family Today tip is brought to you by Boost Kit Essentials Nutritionally Complete Drink, providing your picky eater with essential nutrition and great taste in one drink. Visit us at kitessentials.com. To make sure your kids eat healthy, follow the 5-a-day plan. Serve 3 servings of vegetables and 2 servings of fruit daily. Remember, a serving could just mean a piece of fruit or a half cup of veggies. If your kids are picky eaters, ask a nutritionist about other sources. For more tips like these, visit us at parenthood.com/yourfamilytoday.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
This Your Family Today tip is brought to you by Tombstone Pizza. With multiple varieties to choose from, there's a Tombstone Pizza that's sure to please your family. What do you want on your tombstone? Family dinner is important, but who says it has to be at the table? When life gets busy and the pressure is on, pull out the good paper plates and settle in for pizza and a movie. It's fun, easy, and memorable for the whole family. For more tips like these, visit us at parenthood.com/yourfamilytoday.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of our big two-hour get-together, and we continue our ongoing conversation with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard, interesting conversation in the past segment with the Anxious Gardener's Book of Answers author, Terry Dunn Chase. But, you know, people listening to this program may not know that you have, among the many, many interests and skills you possess and venues that you perform on, you are a very, very experienced interviewer of novelists, fiction, people who write novels. You don't hear that often on the radio. And online at the website podjockey.com, you have, at this point, what, hundreds of hours of conversations with novelists? I mean,
hundreds.
Yeah, that's amazing when you stop and think about it. Somebody who loves literature could sit endlessly forever. If they lined up all of your conversations that you've had with novelists, they would go from here to Roswell, New Mexico, and back.
I love it when they do things like that, when they say, if you lined up every nerve in your body, it would go across the ocean and back again three times.
Okay, let's do it. But I don't quite know how in this modern era of digital recording one measures the length of time. You know, you did it with reel-to-reel tape, you did it with... But you have hours and hours of conversations at podjockey.com, podjockey.com, and the name of the segment of Podjockey that has all of these hours and hours of conversations is called Richard Neer's Novelist Cafe, and it's free. I mean, people like to hear about the, like, well, who are some of the novelists that you have there?
Well, we've got Steve Barry coming up, who's a best-selling author. Mm-hmm. Michael Connelly is on there very often. You know, a guy that we haven't gotten yet because he doesn't do interviews. I just finished his book, Calico Joe. Have you heard of John Grisham's latest book, Michael?
Mm-hmm.
This is a book about a fictional baseball player from Arkansas who comes up to the Cubs in 1973 and plays the Mets. Remember what happened in 1973 with the Cubs and the Mets?
No.
The Mets won the pennant with an 82-79 record that year. One of the worst teams ever to go to the postseason. They beat the Cincinnati Reds. You might remember Bud Harrelson had a fight with Pete Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to the World Series. And they lost in seven games.
Oakland?
Tom Seaver, John Matlack, all
to
those
Oakland?
Guys.
To Oakland?
To Oakland,
I
right.
I remember that. I remember being very disappointed. I was a Mets fan back in those days. I couldn't believe they'd lose because I thought that they had some kind of, you know, magic pixie dust or something because they had won in 69.
Well, this is a fictional book. I just finished reading it, and it's about a kid whose father pitches for the Mets, and there's this guy, Calico Joe, who's this wunderkind from Arkansas who comes to the Cubs, and he hits three home runs in his first three at-bats, has 15 consecutive hits in his first 15 at-bats, and the kid's father, pitching for the Mets, hits him in the head, blinds him in one eye, and the kid never has a career the rest of the way. Pretty interesting premise, huh?
What kind of a sick mind would dream this up? Sorry. No, I'm only kidding about that. That's fascinating. And, wow, I wish we didn't have only 45 seconds to the end of the program. You're going to be interviewing him on Podjockey?
We're trying to get him. Like I say, he doesn't do interviews very often. He's very elusive, but we're going after him.
Well, we'll check it out. I want to continue this conversation next week, so let's look forward to that. Richard Neer, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Beverly Santinello on the front line. Thank you, Carol Marks, the star of the show. Thank you, Kevin Casey and Steve Wiseman, the entire Touch of Grey broadcast family. I'm Michael Harrison on behalf of all of us, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. We'll